Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me in a bit will be Candice LePage, and she will join us to do this week's review. And, I mean, happy May, I guess. It is May the 5th. Yesterday was May the 4th be with you, Star Wars Day. I saw somebody remark on a Babylon 5 Facebook group I follow that maybe May 5th should be Babylon 5 Day. And Babylon 5's kind of gotten a huge kick as they recently dumped the whole series with some improved CG onto HBO Max. So it's getting a lot more love. It's getting a second look by people. And I guess because the fifth day of the fifth month seems like a logical time to have a Babylon 5 Day, so... you know, why not? Happy Babylon 5 Day, everyone. That's going to be celebrated by me and 10 other people listening to the show. Anyway, where am I? End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new haunted house drama Things Heard and Seen, which you can now stream on the Netflix channel. Given the review, you can maybe understand why I'm a little distracted with the idea of Babylon 5 Day. Anyway, to kick off this week's show, and to kick off a little summer series, we're going to celebrate like summer blockbuster season, sort of. Typically, this coming Friday would be like the unofficial kickoff of the summer movie season, and that's like when all the big blockbusters come out. But of course, because so many places are still feeling the pinch of lockdown, and, you know, even major movie markets like New York and Los Angeles, although they've reopened some theaters to limited capacity or some sort of limited capacity, although they are planning on more and more reopening as the summer goes along, it's still really, really hard to get people to go out and go to the movies. So what we're seeing this year is what happened last year, where big releases keep getting moved, pushed back because nobody wants to release their big $200 million blockbuster into an empty theater. Of course, here in Ontario, we know we're probably not going to be going back to the theater for a long time. Still, even though... We are slowly but surely getting vaccinated. We're still somewhere in the neighborhood of like 3,500 new cases a day, which is, you know, about 3,400 more new cases a day than last summer when they allowed theaters to be open in time for the release of Tenet. So we're going to have to live vicariously through past movie seasons for at least another month, maybe 2 months. So this is what I've prepared. I'm going to revisit various summer movie seasons for the next few weeks and see how that goes. So, I'm starting with the summer of 1982 because this was like kind of the first, although there had been blockbusters like Jaws in 75, Star Wars in 77, Raiders in 81. The summer of 82 was kind of like the first time it seemed like studios were really playing into this whole idea of the summer blockbuster movie season, a time of movies with franchise potential, a time of sequels, big animated movies. So I thought I would just go down the list of what came out in the summer of 1982 and what made that so particularly interesting. So starting with May 7th, not exactly what you would think of when it comes to blockbuster material, but Diner, one of Barry Levinson's first movies, and a highly influential one at that, still to this day, even though it's about a group of friends hanging out in, like, 1959. There's still something to it thematically, and in terms of the various friendships and relationships going on in the movie that still resonates today, that people still seek out Diner. It also helps that it's, like, this movie that brings together a lot of this great talent. Some of them for the first time. It was Paul Reiser's first movie. It was Tim Daly's first movie. I think it was Ellen Barkin's first movie. But it also has Steve Guttenberg, Daniel Stern, Mickey Rourke, Kevin Bacon. It is like a murderer's row of people, of great acting talent. On May 14th, we had Conan the Barbarian, Did I just stutter that? Conan the Barbarian? Anyway, Conan the Barbarian, it was Arnold Schwarzenegger's kind of big breakthrough film. Before that, he had been in this film. He'd also been in that documentary about weightlifting that a certain famous clip was taken from. But before that, he was in this movie, Hercules in New York, which he was dubbed. Somebody dubbed over his voice, famously. But Conan the Barbarian was the first time Arnold was sort of allowed to be in his completely natural element. I mean, this is him fresh off his bodybuilding career. He had a certain charisma. People could see that. He wasn't just like a weightlifter. There was some serious sort of star power going on there. And Conan the Barbarian was able to balance that really, really well. If you look at the career of Arnold Schwarzenegger and the career of Dwayne Johnson, there are some interesting parallels there. That Dwayne Johnson goes into the movie business, chooses roles that he's able to parlay his reputation and his star power as a WWE wrestler, and then slowly migrates from that to being able to like choose more complex roles, more complex projects, and Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of plays that trail. On May 21st, we had Annie, I didn't really realize this until I was looking at his name on the credits, but one of John Huston's last movies. I think it was his fourth to last movie, Annie, the Broadway musical based on the cartoon strip character, the orphan who finds a family with a wealthy billionaire, which almost kind of seems seedy now that this, you know, single white billionaire adopts little redheaded girl out of the goodness of his heart. That seems like the start of a very different movie if it were to be made now, I think, unfortunately. May 28th, we get Rocky III. Overlooked in terms of the Rockies, I think. I think a lot of people, because Rocky 1 and Rocky 2, they're kind of, I mean, they're not two halves of the same thing, but, you know, Rocky 2 continues the story of Rocky 1, and where do you go in Rocky 3? And then in Rocky 4, you get this whole sort of jingoism, patriotism, Reagan-era stuff with the appearance of this Soviet fighter who first kills Apollo Creed, and spoiler alert for Rocky 4, and then challenges Rocky, and they have this big face-off. It's, you know, the Soviet Union didn't fall until 1991, but it basically fell in Rocky IV because Rocky beat, I can't even remember his name, Dolph Lundgren. I can't remember his character's name, but there you go, because I'm so focused on Rocky III, in which Rocky's beloved trainer, Burgess Meredith, Mickey's the name of the character, dies, and Rocky is set on this path of self-doubt because Mickey confesses before he dies that Rocky's been defending his heavyweight title against fighters of, let's say, lesser stature. So there are a lot of interesting sort of dynamics about celebrity and having to test oneself to make sure that you are the best champion that you are. I think it is the most underrated. Rocky V is underrated for good cause. Rocky III, I think, is underrated for not good cause. So we get to June 4th. We get Poltergeist and Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan on the same weekend. That would not happen now. You would not get the Steven Spielberg-produced Haunted House movie and the sequel to a major franchise picture on the same weekend. That just would not happen. But in 1982, it did happen. They were both hits, and I've talked about those movies before on the show. So I'll leave it there. On June 11th, you get another interesting face-off. You get E.T. the Extraterrestrial and Grease 2. One of those movies would go on to be the biggest movie of all time for at least a period of 15 years. The other one would go down in history as like an example of, I guess, how not to do a sequel. Although Grease 2 famously was like one of the first starring roles for Michelle Pfeiffer. And at least that part of it paid off. I couldn't even begin to tell you who else was in Grease 2, but I will. Max Caulfield is the male lead. Christopher MacDonald is in it. Peter Frechette is in it, too. So, I mean, there are some Eve Arden is in it. There are some names. Connie Stevens, I assume, is... I haven't seen Grease 2 in a while, but... Anyway. There are some names in it, but everyone was talking about E.T. the Extraterrestrial, and it's funny, I remember thinking back about E.T. the Extraterrestrial. We have a thing now where studios have arranged it so that the window between theatrical release and home video release, which is now predominantly video on demand, is like so short. It's like 45 days now. E.T. took years to come out on VHS, because it was, I remember when it came out on VHS, it was a huge deal. They finally released E.T. on VHS, and it was like 1988, I think. It came out in 82, but it didn't come out on VHS until like 1988 or 89. It was really, really incredible. I'm skipping the June 18th weekend. There really wasn't anything memorable there. And going right to June 25th, because then we here have this next team up, Blade Runner and The Thing. Both movies, at the time, bombed. But both movies have had this resurgence in recent years of this, like, critical reconception. Of course, Blade Runner, famously after Ridley Scott's working cut kind of got out and people got to see what he was playing with. And famously, Harrison Ford recently at the Oscars read the studio notes from Blade Runner, which, you know, sort of reminds you of why studio notes aren't sometimes the greatest. But once Ridley Scott's working cut got out and once he was able to sort of formally release his director's cut, people started taking Blade Runner... started taking a serious look at Blade Runner again. The Thing never needed a director's cut, though. It was just always great. and just slowly over time, people started to take a look at this movie, which, you know, came after this stretch from John Carpenter where he had Halloween, and he had Escape from New York. And, he was on a roll. And then you get to The Thing, which kind of bombs. Highly ambitious, but it bombs. And people, I guess, hopped over it for years and then would eventually come back to it. But it is such a great movie in its own right, and I'm glad that it was redeemed at some point. On July 2nd, The Secrets of NIMH came out. This was the first full-length feature film from Don Bluth. If there was a name in animation that wasn't Disney in the 80s, it was Don Bluth. He would go on to make Land Before Time, An American Tale, All Dogs Go to Heaven. What's interesting, too, about Don Bluth is, like, he was kind of a cast-off. Disney was in this period at the time where they were not cranking out animated classics the way they used to. And as a result, they were kind of, like, hemorrhaging talent, and Don Bluth was one of those people. Tim Burton would end up being another one of those people as well. Tim Burton, a unique case where Disney had no idea what to do with him. But there was just this period where creatives weren't being allowed to be as creative as they wanted to at Disney, so they ended up striking out on their own. And Don Bluth was one of the first, and he was one of the few ones to enjoy real success outside of Disney. And The Secret of NIMH was the first in a line of hits for him. July 9th, speaking of Disney, Tron came out. I personally don't get Tron. That is a me thing. But, you know, revisiting the original Tron movie, I do sort of... It is oddly prescient in its way. It's about this idealistic computer programmer who's taken advantage of, he's abused, he's thrown out of the company, he's got a lot of really great idealism about technology. Meanwhile, the guy in charge of the company is this, like, megalomaniac who steals and, thinks he's more talented than he is. And the whole movie is about how he basically gets his comeuppance in the end, vis-a-vis this trip through this computer-generated world, which is, like, the first of its kind. Again, I don't necessarily get Tron, but I do understand a lot of the themes and a lot of the ideas that it brought to the table now more than ever, because I think, you know, the filmmakers were kind of really ahead of their times, like 30, 40 years ahead of their times. So it's interesting to revisit Tron now from that perspective. July 23rd. This is like a really highbrow weekend, and actually, this point of July is usually the point in the summer season where you get some more adult fare, shall we say, some more highbrow entertainment. So on this weekend, you get The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, which is based on the Broadway musical starring Burt Reynolds and Dolly Parton. Great, unique team-up of talent there. And then you also get The World According to Garp, based on the John Irving novel starring the late, great Robin Williams. It's kind of a first for him in terms of taking on, like, really dramatic material. You know, he was mostly known for Mork and Mindy and for his the high wire stand-up comedy he did and the impressions and things. And this was Robin Williams saying, no, look, I can do other stuff. And speaking of, like, predicates for later, I think Jim Carrey probably modeled a lot of what he did in his career after Robin Williams, that, you know, Jim Carrey exploited his own pretensions for madcap comedy, and then after establishing himself as a success, started to veer off into exploring other areas for his talent. And I will end with this. The weekend of August the 13th, you had a three-car pileup in the forms of Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Friday the 13th, Part 3, and An Officer and a Gentleman. So literally something for everyone at the box office that weekend. Friday the 13th, Part 3, of course, famous for the first time Jason puts on the hockey mask. And if you're a teen and you didn't want something scary but still R-rated flavor, you got Fast Times. Again, one of those movies that had, like, an explosion of talent with Sean Penn, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Phoebe Cates, who else? Eric Stoltz, Nick Cage, Nancy Wilson, Anthony Edwards, the whole shebang. Judge Reinhold, he was a thing for a while. We'll leave it there and get right into a haunted house movie. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. But an old house on the Danforth. She loves me and her body keeps me warm. I'm happy that this is where we used to live. Broke into the old apartment.
I'm new in town and I would love to learn more about the older homes in the area. I don't know anybody up here.
Well, you do now.
My wife doesn't know what happened here. I think it'd be better if we kept it that way.
Everything in the natural world has a counterpart in the spiritual realm.
We're all so inconsequential.
I say death is only the beginning.
My wife is the true believer of the family.
You do not want to get us started on all that stuff.
What the? And that was a clip from Things Heard and Seen. It's the new film from Sherry Springer Berman and Robert Pulcini, and it stars Amanda Seyfried, James Norton, Natalia Dyer, Alex Neustander, Rhea Seehorn, Karen Allen, and F. Murray Abraham. So I'm now being joined on the old Skype machine by Candace LaPage. Candace, how are you today?
I'm doing all right. I'm now picturing my computer as like a big fax machine or teletype or something skyping its way through the interwebs.
Yeah, you know, it could be a thing, right? Where Google is the one search engine everyone uses. Maybe one day there will be like an end to the teleconferencing wars and everyone will just use Zoom, and then when you talk about Skype, everyone's like, it's like the old Alta Vista gag on Parks and Rec, right? And everyone's like, what the heck are you talking about, Alta Vista?
It's, yeah. I wish the joke was Ask Jeeves. That was my favorite. That was the best search engine back in the day.
it was too snooty for me. It was too highbrow. It's like, hey, you know what it's like to have a butler in real life? Well, now you have a butler online. Well, that joke fell flat. Anyway, I have to workshop that some more. Speaking of things in the past, our review this week is Things Heard and Seen, which is a ghost story that takes place in 1980. And it seems to be a thing that a lot of these ghost stories that are being made, these like kind of serious haunting movies, take place in times past. I saw one review of this movie that said 1980 was a great time for ghosts because, you know, no one had camera phones and no one had, you know, cell phones. And you had to go to the library to look up the history of your spooky old house. You couldn't mm-hmm. just sit at home on your computer. So I think that's the reason why we're getting this 1980 set haunted house movie. But aside from that, Candace, why did you want to check this out, and what did you think of Things Heard and Seen?
Yeah. Well, I think I've managed most of this fresh year of pandemic style end credits without going back to the well of horror yet. So felt like time. I did see that this was coming out just this week, and had heard a couple of things about it, but not too much. But, you know, I like Amanda Seyfried a lot. And I think, I mean, it clearly looked like it was a bit of a gothic horror, which is it feels weird to say, but it's like a comforting style of horror film. Like, it's just kind of like a warm, cozy blanket of horror where, you know, you can watch it whenever and you know you're probably not going to get terrified by it. But, you know, you might be left with a little bit of, like, you know, chills, I guess, or thinky thoughts, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as we call them. We so cleverly call them thinky thoughts. And... you know, the gothic horror tends to stem so much from or include, I'll say romance, but not really romance, obviously, especially in this particular one, but relationship, I guess. They're very relationship-based sort of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, again, it's just because I've been watching so many damn Hallmark movies that... delving more into people's relationships seems to be something that I'm feeling lately. And I liked this story overall. I think, you know, there's more to say about it, but I think overall that I liked this. I like this sort of look into one couple's dysfunction,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and trying to sort of figure it out, and without it being tawdry. You know, I read the after having watched the film, I went and looked up, because it says based on a book called All Things Cease to Be, I think is what it's called.
All Things Cease to Appear by Elizabeth Brunage.
Yeah. And so I read the you know, a little bit about the book, and the book description feels like it reads a bit more like I don't know, but like a sort of a tawdry crime mystery sort of thing, where mm-hmm. even the film itself did sort of start with the end, the crime, essentially, and then go back in time. But I don't, then from that point forward, the film went really chronologically. In the book, when I read the sort of synopsis of it, seems like it felt more like a Gone Girl style story, mm-hmm. where, you know, we're going through it and discovering things. So this, I felt, you know, the film, like I said, it's that warm, cozy, gothic, domestic violence story, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those comforting old stories.
I almost wish this was the tawdry version of this. You mentioned Hallmark movies, and that automatically made me think of Lifetime movies, which are essentially boiled down to your life is bad, your husband is bad, he does bad things, get out of there before he does bad things to you, and that essentially is how this works out. It's an interesting cast. The cast is very good. A lot of great actors. I think there's one glaring misfire, which is the main actor who plays the husband, George, James Norton. It may play into the broader problem that I found with the movie, which is just that it plays out in this like monotone where, like, no matter how emotional a scene is, or where it falls on like the emotional register, it just kind of works out the same. And I found that particularly glaring focusing on the George character because, he's supposed to, we find out things in the course of the film that, he's kind of lied about. He's kind of leading a double life and, he's supposed to be this sort of professor that is, everyone likes and everyone thinks is pretty cool, but he always seems kind of like straightforward and dickish, which makes me wonder like how he's been allowed to get this far in life, like, because if you're living that big of a con, this kind of long con, then it's implied that this guy has lived, if not all of his life, at least most of his life with his wife Amanda Seyfried, that he should come off as like charming, as someone you want to hang out with and spend time with, and I felt none of that, and maybe that's because we're constantly meant to feel sympathy for her, and like straight from the beginning we kind of automatically dismiss him as someone who is sympathetic to her needs, and it's clearly not the case from the beginning. But I just wish that the character, it just didn't fall so easily into the trap right off the bat that you're supposed to believe this guy, the husband, is scum, when it's the nature of the story clearly is she discovers although she probably suspects he's scum at before the movie, because it's implied that she has a lot of issues with how they got married and the reasons why she got pregnant. She's a good Catholic girl, so they got married before the child was born. The first years of their marriage were just awash in childcare and these other concerns that didn't really focus on their own sort of married relationship or how they would navigate being a couple and living together and all that stuff. But it just the spotlight of suspicion is always on this guy, and it just feels like the story dead ends really fast. You always have one eye on the husband, right?
Yeah, and I mean I definitely agree with you, but what's interesting is that what I take from that is something very different, in that at every moment of this movie, it seemed so clearly to be, even within the film, everything was so clearly from the point of view of a woman, whether it was his wife, his colleague, his mistress, his real estate agent, all of these women in his life knew. And and to me that was so stark, because there is always this, women can spot the guy in the crowd that's kind of like, I mean, it comes back to Promising Young Woman a little bit, right? Where she would go out fishing for the nice guy, and she could tell who it was, right? She knew who was going to be the nice guy, who was actually going to try to take advantage of her when given the opportunity. And so while I agree, yes, like right from the get-go, it was clear that George was going to be the problem in this story. it was also clear to all these women, right? Like the one, his real estate agent, who was played by Karen Allen, which was so great to see her. That was yeah. really fun. The second she appeared on screen, I was like, oh, I wish she had a bigger role, but that's okay. Yeah. I'll take what I can get. Yeah. But, you know, she said it, right? Because her husband is the sheriff. And she says, I know that it was him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he has to be brought to justice because I know it was him. Mm-hmm. And how does she know? Like, she doesn't know anything. You know, we watched it happen as the viewers, but there's really, you know, even the sheriff is like, I yeah, but like, there's just no proof.
Right.
And so I think that's, you know, yeah, I guess it's just interesting because I agree with what you're saying. That you know, it was so clear from the get-go, and that there never seemed to be much in the way of, like,
mm-hmm.
Stress or, like, conflict or anything. It just was like, let's just watch this unfold as it mm-hmm. happens. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's kind of funny. So as I was watching this film, because I feel like one of the people I heard talk about it just briefly said that it was Amityville meets, oh, I can't remember which other film it was. But as I was watching it, I was like, oh, this is actually Amityville meets The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that in The Talented Mr. Ripley, as things just continue to spiral out of control for, and I haven't actually read the book, though I own it. I keep wanting to read it. So I'm just talking about the movie. But as things spiral out of control for the Matt Damon character, I find myself rooting for him to say, like, oh, if he could just get through this one, he could maybe finally be better or be happy or be, you know, at peace. And it's the exact opposite sort of feeling here.
Right.
As you just kind of keep going, oh, you know, who is finally going to be the one to bring him to justice? Who's finally going to be the one who has the right piece of the puzzle? Because they all have different pieces who can finally, like, uncover the truth about this guy.
Yeah, no, that I get. I think the difference between that is I don't think, even as a man watching this, I don't think even, you know, I felt compelled to root for George at any point. And again, it's because it's from the female point of view. It's from the point of view of Catherine, the Amanda Seyfried character. And it is interesting because I could feel sort of it's one of these movies that is set in the 80s, and I do get the joke that I mentioned before that, you know, you want to set your ghost story in pre-Google times to, you know, justify the legwork, I guess. But there is a very, in terms of capturing that sense of the times, you know, that you can have at this same time in this same world, you could have the Catherine character who feels smothered by the husband who's pursuing all his career ambitions while she gets stuck at home and you know, is like defaulted into the role as caregiver and housewife and those sorts of things. But at the same time, it's also a world in which you do have strong women like the Justine character who is able to have, you know, a career and is able to say, no, I didn't want to have kids. And it turned out that was the right decision for me. And it is playing against, I think, sort of modern notions that we understand. Like, the point you're making is that it's understood the whole time that George is a bad dude. You know, and over the course of the film, you come to understand just how bad a dude he is. But the flip side of it is, too, there's a kind of escalation. Like, when you're watching The Talented Mr. Ripley, it's kind of understood, like, this is someone who will, like, literally do anything. But again, this comes back to the characterization of George, where he seems kind of mealy and meek and, you know, the nice guy, as you mentioned. But then it escalates, like, into, like, a quick succession of, like, three different murders that you really don't have. At least for me, there wasn't really a lot of time to, like, sort of process things. Because this wasn't really a story, like, how a psychopath is made, or you know, yeah. how to advance through murder, or one of these stories. It's this very, like, for the first like hour and 15 minutes, it's this very like slow pitch, this very methodical, like, unhappy couple moves into house with tortured history and trying to understand the connections between what happened in the house in the past and what's going on in the house now. And then we kind of just segue into like this. He goes full Jason Voorhees, like, at one point, where it's just like, you know, when you watch those Friday the 13th movies, it's like Jason Voorhees just walking around. He sees a person, kills them, walking around, sees someone else, kills them. And it's just, it's, there's no rhyme or reason to it. And it feels like we get to that point in the film, but then the film doesn't take sort of any enjoyment in, we are seeing George come into his like element as a man who will do anything to keep his manliness. And, you know, that it's that same monotone throughout the movie that I think, you know, the movie shifts radically in tone at some point, but the tone doesn't keep up, if you follow my drift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think part of that too is, because it's a movie, and I feel like there are definitely pieces of story that couldn't be naturally put into the movie. Like, you know, is this the first time that he has done this? Right? Like, we find out about a family member who passed away when he was younger.
Right.
Was that a natural act, or was it not? We never really find that out, and perhaps in the book there is a little bit more about that and a little bit more about him, his father. You know, there's so much about his story that we actually never find out, and I think that that's okay, again, from the movie point of view, because it's told from all of the women's points of view,
right. But
you know, right from the get-go, we find out that he had been taking money from his parents. So presumably he comes from a fairly well-to-do family, and his parents had been taking care of him. And you talk about him being mild and meek. I think you forgot the third M, which is mediocre.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we do find out that he basically is not good at anything, potentially including...
Yeah.
You know, losing his mind. But so, you know, we don't know much about his family, what they did, why they had so much money, why they were supporting him, or why they cut him off, which is what sort of starts this career path of his at this new college, because his parents have cut him off and, you know, oh no, now they're having money problems. And then they have the dinner where the parents actually arrive and his father is... not a nice person. His father immediately, you know, comes out and talks about, you know, is talking about how sinful essentially it is to be homosexual. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. So I think that there's potentially a lot of story there that we're not given in the movie. And perhaps the actor, James Norton, was not really given as any sort of like, here's a little backstory on your character. Because yeah, he did sort of play it kind of, I mean, I don't want to say dead-eyed, because there was a bit, a certain piece where he did kind of become dead-eyed. And that was the only place where I kind of went, oh, okay. He really is like an empty shell of a psychopath who's been pretending this whole time. But his pretending, yeah, it's not very good.
But there's a talent to dead-eyed, right? Like, you know, to be able to look not maybe perhaps not literally, but to look at the camera and just like portray that you are like just a void inside. Like that's not an easy thing to pull off necessarily either. And you know, it could be a matter of the direction too, because one of the directors is a woman, Sherry Springer Burnham. So it could be just like a matter of we are telling this from the women's perspective, and I mean, and that's perhaps why like all these things are treated like sort of revelation. But you know, it just, from my perspective, it just feels so weird that, you know, it gets to the point where he's just like, I forgot the thing about the cousin. I like, maybe I bring my own predispositions into it, that just accepting that the cousin did drown, so that when we get to the scene where he drowns his mentor in the lake, you're like, wow, that seemed to be pretty easy for him, because you don't automatically think, I'm in career trouble, I'm gonna drown my boss. But I mean, that's a point too, and perhaps those links could have been drawn a bit more clearly. But it's perhaps one of those things that you don't really appreciate until you see the whole thing sort of unfold. But there are things, there are signs of life in this that I found like just kind of bizarre. Like there's a scene at that dinner you're talking about with the husband, with the in-laws, and he's going on about this is at the point where you it is revealed that these beautiful paintings that George has hanging up in his office that he allegedly once painted in his days before he realized he was more of a writer than an artist, allegedly. And it is revealed that they were painted by the dead cousin, and his, you know, his art, you know, mysteriously disappeared after his suicide. And Amanda Seyfried excuses herself, and it's revealed early in the film she's bulimic, or she has some sort of eating disorder, but she's throwing up in the toilet, and he's like, he comes in and he goes, oh, this again? And she's like, I'm throwing up our marriage, which is just such a tart line to come out of nowhere in this like very straight-edged dialogue. And then there's a later scene where Justine confronts George, where they're talking about a scarf that George had her George asked her to make, allegedly for his daughter, but essentially for his mistress. And Justine confronts him over it, and he says, oh, well, I gave it to my mother, but she thought it was a little cheap. And Justine fires back, well, that makes sense, given like whose neck I saw it around. And it's like, that's like another 10 point. That's another 10 point line fired. There's such great moments like that, that I wish the film like I don't need it to be a comedy, but I just, yeah. You know, I feel like I needed some more tartness in this. It's just it's played a little too straight consistently for my taste.
Yeah. And I'll definitely say, you know, I talk about how maybe there's story missing, but the film was 2 hours long and should not have been longer. I don't feel that it was too long. I liked it at that length, but I will say that probably 80 of those minutes were mood and not story.
For sure.
And you know, if you're into that, if you're like, and it's funny because I sort of, it's interesting you bring up the Lifetime movies, which are these like tawdry primetime sort of cable films.
Mm-hmm.
And Netflix seems to have the market on these slow-moving kind of gothic-y horrors. Like this mm-hmm. reminded me a lot of a few other ones they've put out, which of course I can't think of the name of, the All the Pretty Horses, I think, or something about walls. Gosh, I can't remember any of them, but. These like sort of, there was a like a Victorian era sort of ghost story. I could not tell you what actually happened. I just remember that I watched it and it was the same thing. It was just like this lovely sort of gothic mood. Mm-hmm. And so again, I come back to, if you feel like I do, that a nice gothic horror is just a warm, cozy blanket to put on on an afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
This is the movie for you. I think it really achieved that sort of that feeling. It's interesting because there is, I mean, we're talking all about the domestic dysfunction and not remotely about the actual ghost story. And yeah. I think because there's not, I mean, there is a lot of that, but ultimately I think you could argue that it doesn't really connect to the story at all. You know, again, when you're talking about George and how you didn't, you felt like there was a quick escalation from, oops, I've been found out to, okay, let's start dealing with this. But this is where the Amityville part comes in, right? You can choose to believe. I don't personally. Obviously, this is a person who came into this home already with this problem. Oh, it was The Shining. It was Amityville meets The Shining is what right. someone was telling me was like. Because we're led to believe that the house has some violent backstory. And the previous owners, there was a domestic dispute. And the second husband, so not the stepfather of a few of the kids, essentially killed his family, except not all of them died, mm-hmm. by, you know, fumes from the garage and things like that. And there are times that we see George go to the garage and just sit there with the car running. Mm-hmm. And there are whispers and voices sometimes that I didn't watch with the closed captioning on, so I wasn't really sure what they were saying sometimes because it was very, very quiet. But I think that you could choose to watch this movie and believe that he was possessed or affected by the spirits. But then there's also the, if you do that, then you have to believe there's the other side where there's this good spirit who's trying to help Catherine the whole time. And, you know, what are we left with there? So, you know, do you want to even bring the spiritual sort of ghost story side into it or just leave it out entirely? It's kind of this weird.
Yeah. And thing. And the good spirit basically leaves her hang out to dry at some point. And like, you'd think that. The whole, again, because the whole background of the house and everything isn't thoroughly explained, but if it's like, this house is, and I think the Karen Allen character makes the point at some point, like, there's something about the house, you know, that all these couples moving in ends with, like, a man murdering his wife, that, you know, there's something going on in this house, some sort of, like, ancient, maybe not ancient, but, you know, some sort of, you know, past struggle of like male dominance over female willfulness or female you know determination to break free of certain roles. You know, there's the whole Bible she finds where somebody's name is scratched out and it says damned afterwards, which is of course, you know, makes you think about things like the witch trials and, you know, women being damned and cursed because, you know, for all the reasons women were cast as witches in the past. And it just, yeah, there's some sort of, again, there's some sort of subtext going on that is not thoroughly explained. And the stuff I found with the ghost, and it's one of the reasons why I don't think it's come up very much in this conversation, but like the ghost effects were garbage. I'm sorry. Like it came across as very like OG Unsolved Mysteries where it's like people with gray face paints that are like double imposed over a scene and, you know, lights going on and off. And there's like this shimmer effect at one point where the ghost is trying to draw Catherine's attention. It's like, no, like this is, yeah, this is set in the 80s, but we don't need the 80s effects. Like do better.
I do wonder if some of that was deliberate because ultimately, the ghosts that we see are benevolent.
Sure.
Right. And so maybe that's part of it, where they didn't want it to actually seem scary, because how then can you sort of have this woman talk about how, you know, she feels like a kinship to the ghost in the house, and that she's good if, mm-hmm. if like everybody else sees it as scary like that. And right. it is sort of interesting, again, coming back to, you know, Catherine seeing the ghosts, and George certainly talks about how she seems to have a bit of a, you know, a fairly open mind when it comes to occult. And he, of course, makes fun of her for it, because that's mm-hmm. the kind of person he is. And mm-hmm. then she also has this eating disorder. And so as we're finding out more about her, there are so many of the things that typically in horror movies are used by the characters to gaslight the women, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Like, and they started sort of introducing that with the bulimia and the eating disorder. You know, are you seeing things?
Right.
And she even sort of thinks it a little bit, but it's quickly dismissed that it's that's not it. And I was glad to see that they didn't, you know, chalk these things up to her being,
mm-hmm.
you know, hallucinating, or to her not, to her, you know, just toying with the other side, for instance.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting film, and I think if you want to watch it to look for these sorts of like ways that they chose to put things on their head, you know, take tropes and make them a little bit different, you can. But it's also a made for Netflix movie.
Yeah, that's
right. Like, if they did this in a big blockbuster, not a blockbuster, but a big like theater release, sort of the way that I'm having a lot of problems like making my brain work,
or something like that, like sort of like one of these like medium budget things that, you know, you're going to attract a more adult audience, shall we say, than necessarily, you know, the blockbustery crowd you're talking about. But I know what you mean, that it's a movie made for Netflix. It's a movie made for you to come across as you are flipping through the trending now tab, and like, ooh, things seen and not heard. Well, that sounds sort of okay. Maybe I should check it out, because I'm just looking for something to watch.
Yeah.
No, I hear you on that. I think I read one review where somebody said it best, that this is the movie is most interesting when it's putting a toxic marriage under a microscope. You almost don't need the supernatural bits. This may be a matter of the filmmakers cramming a lot into, I mean, it's a 2-hour running time already, but it just, you know, it could have afforded to be a little more clear in some of the lines it was drawing. But I mean, it, having said that too, I don't think it's a fail as a movie. I think there are a lot of interesting bits to it, and it's certainly a great cast, and it's, yeah, I'm not disappointed by this pick at all, but there are definitely things in the pick that disappointed me. Anyway, Candace, if people want to talk more about ghost stories or their toxic marriage with you, how can people find you on the internet?
Goodness. You can find me anywhere on the internet at Cinn48, that's CINN48. And I don't know if I'm the best person to talk to about your toxic marriage, but, you know, if you got things you need to say, feel free.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean. Or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And while you're at Spotify, you can find the playlist for almost all the music that you hear on End Credits every week. Just look for End Credits on CFRU in the Spotify app and click play to hear all that music. You can find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and you can find my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. You can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for another great episode? Sure. Let's say great episode of End Credits, and we will see you then.